You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Lamb Goat presents the Van Flip Podcast.
What is up? Welcome to this week's episode of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. On this week, we have Andrew and Chris from one of the earliest metalcore bands you could probably remember, Sky Came Falling from Long Island. Welcome to the show, guys. How are you doing today?
Doing good.
How's it going?
Pretty good. You guys have been pretty busy as of late. We just got back from New York, and me and my buddy JP, who's also a partner here at Lamb Goat with me, we flew to New York to see the PTW shows, and you guys were on two of those shows that we saw, or the two that we saw, I should say. There's three shows altogether. But yeah, I think that was like probably my first time ever seeing you, because I don't think I saw you back in the late 90s, early 2000s when you were, you know, more active, but it was a pleasant surprise seeing you in Indecision on the lineup in real life, finally.
Yeah, I don't think we played Florida much when we were an active band. We tended to somehow end up avoiding it for whatever reason.
It's a hard place to come to, you know, because like if you want to hit any of the spots in Florida, they're usually more south than like say where I'm at in North Florida, Jacksonville. You usually want to go to like Orlando or Miami or South Florida or Tampa, but then, you know, that's a drive coming from the closest place. The closest major city would be Atlanta. So, you know, it's another 5-6 hour drive until you get to Florida. So usually bands make it like a whole weekend / week thing when they come down here. You know, they'd hit like 5 cities or something like that.
Yeah, I think we played Magic Fest in Orlando 1 year, and then one time we went down to South Florida. And that was our first tour, actually. Other than that, I think all of our other tours, for whatever reason, just bypassed. We ended up, you know, usually going from Valdosta, Georgia, and then Atlanta, and then up.
Yeah, the early days when you were a lot more VFW halls and weird, strange basement shows back in the day. Speaking of which,
GPS too.
GPS. That's one of the wildest things I think about. Because I toured in my little crappy band too, and it was a lot of luckily for us, like my dad always had atlases around, and that was like one of his things that he would like look at in the bathroom. You know, like when he was in the bathroom for a long period of time, he would just look at an atlas. And so I just would do it out of habit too. So I could read an atlas pretty well, but luckily we also had MapQuest was like on the, you know, cusp of the beginning of like directional options for you to like look up stuff, but you had to like print the directions out. You couldn't like
it's like on your seat and you're like checking it.
Yeah, we had at the time what came out that was pretty hot right around the middle of the band was Microsoft had that Maps program that was a CD that didn't require internet.
Wow.
So that was it was like just basically like a downloadable map, and you could kind of figure out where you were. And we were using that. And I think there was like some kind of plugin or something that you were able to figure out where you were. But this is like way before any of the technology that exists today.
Yeah, that sounds like it's before TomTom and all that stuff.
We never had any of that.
Yeah, you used to have to download the maps on that too. That wasn't, you know, as accurate. You could have old TomTom information, you know, and be going in the wrong direction or not on the right proper road back in the day.
It's not the paper traffic updates.
Yeah,
I remember.
True, yeah.
I remember that. But yeah, all of this was before any of that. I mean, we were booking our tours with phone calls and would stop at a payphone and be like, are we going in the right direction? And
a lot of payphones.
Then we'd be like, this is the time we're going to get in, et cetera. And yeah, I think toward the end of the band is when it kind of started to cell phones became a little more widespread, but otherwise, yeah, we didn't have any of that.
Yeah, my first tour was like 04, and I think by that time Sidekicks and all that stuff were already kind of like, you know, the mainstay in our little scene. Everyone had a little AIM, you know, flip screen Sidekick thing, and I didn't, but you could look up some things on there. But yeah, it was a lot of pulling over at like rest stops, busting out the Atlas in the middle of the night and just like looking at like, well, where are we, you know? So I'm amazed we ever got anywhere, to be honest with you, especially like in the, like I just said, like really off the beaten path like VFW halls and little venues that you would have to play. They're not like really well-known spots. So tours working in general back in the day are like insane to comprehend now because it's so easy. You know, you have it on your phone and the directions tell you how many feet you have to go to before you take a left. It's crazy.
I mean, just the fact that people would book us and had never heard the band. I mean, I would call people out of state and be like, I got your phone number from so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, okay, I could do a show for you on this date. Like, not sight unseen, never hearing the band, just knowing our name. And, or, you know, obviously we weren't a big band, you know, and would we get a demo out at the time and they would just let us play their city and sleep in their place. So it was a pretty wild experience back then.
Yeah. What, like, how many tours did you guys do before you guys had a longer break there?
So when we first started the band, our bass player was actually in high school. So we would only do like breaks, you know, as mm-hmm. we were touring. But I think once we hit 99, we toured full time. I think we were home for 2 or 3 months out of the year, up until about 2003, I think. So we were basically full time for about 4 years.
And then that's just you guys booking your own stuff, or did you have help from like Ferret or anything like that at that time?
We had, I think right in the middle, we connected with Jim Grimes from Chicago. I think his booking agency was Handsome Devil at the time. He was doing like Martyr and Another Victim and a couple other bands, and he got us. We worked with him for a few years, and then toward the end, I think we got a couple tours, but they were always through the other bands, like booking agents. Like when we did a tour with Bloodlet, it was through their agent. When we did a tour with Under Oath, it was through theirs.
Yeah, you guys were like, I don't want to say the, you know, you're not originators of metalcore, but you're definitely within that first wave of metalcore. And I don't know if you guys consider yourselves metalcore, because obviously it was, metalcore's turned into a little something different these days than like the dead guy version of it. But you know, when you listen back, because I spent most of the day listening to like your early stuff, also because you're re-releasing for the first time ever on vinyl 1021, which we'll talk about, but yeah, you're releasing that, and I spent some time with that today. And actually, I was at I went to Tiger Records here in town, and that's kind of our little scene record store. It's owned by James Abani of Bane and Casey Jones and all those bands. So it curates to our little audience here in town. But I actually found Forever Embraced by the Sun on CD there. Yeah, so I was like, oh, well, I'll pick that one up because I didn't have that one. So you never know what's going to come through that little spot. You know, he buys collections all the time, so I thought that was cool. But, it must have been very strange to get tours like that because, obviously, like, the genre wasn't really as well-defined as it is now or as it would become in the mid to late 2000s and early 2010s, but you know, it's kind of crazy that you would just call up people out of the blue and be like, yeah. So, like,
yeah.
Would you negotiate, like, a fee? And like, how often would you get paid the fee?
I mean, there were times we were lucky. I can remember, I think it was one of our very first tours. I booked it myself, and I called someone from North Carolina who gave me Dave's number from Prayer for Cleansing. Mm. And Dave was like, I have Harvest coming through. Do you guys want to play the show? So we were like, sure. So like, you know, we were looking for a date and he just happened to have like another date. So we took that date. And then, so shows like that, you know, often we do a little bit better shows by ourselves. You know, I mean, we were happy to make gas money just to get to where we were going. For us at the time, it was like, we were just doing this on the break that we had, right? Like Matt and I think Cameron were both in high school at the time. So when we first started, it was summertime that we were just going out and doing this. And I think for a lot of the guys, it was really their, you know, it was their first time on tour.
Yeah.
So we were happy to just play and play anywhere for anyone. And there were times we would show up to a show and just say, hey, we're from New York and we don't have a show today. Can we hop on your show? And sometimes we got lucky and they let us play. Other times they'd let us set up merch. Other times we, you know, just got to stay in the show for free.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember we did it to a show in Florida. I'm trying to think. Vero Beach, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We showed up to a show. Kaven and I were on tour at the same time as us.
Oh, wow.
And we showed up there, and they were like, you guys can sell merch. We don't have any spots on the show for you guys to play. So we just set up merch and hung out, watched Caven and Iyer.
Hey, what's up? It's Lurk. Looks like you're enjoying the podcast. If you are and you like what we're doing here on the Van Flip, why don't you go ahead and pause this and give us a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening to. If you want to find out any information on your favorite bands from the hardcore and metal scene, visit lambgoat.com. And to stay in the loop about everything that we post on lambgoat.com, make sure you like us on Facebook and you head over to Twitter and Instagram and follow us at lambgoat. Are you a full-grown adult and you also have a TikTok account? Congrats. Follow us on TikTok as well. You can find us under the username lambgoat.com. That's spelled out D-O-T-C-O-M. Head over to our YouTube channel where we have all of these podcasts in video format, plus a lot more content that you should check out. Make sure you hit that subscribe button and you hit that notification bell so you're always alerted when we upload new content. And last but not least, if you want to follow me, Lurk, the host of the show, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at LurkCity. And as always, if you need any of the links that pertain to the artists on the show today, Lambgoat, or myself, you can always find them in the description. Thanks for listening to this message. Now let's get back to the show. How does that work out though when you're selling merch at the venue and the bands are like, yeah, loved you, or the people come up like, loved you guys, and you're like, yeah, totally, yeah, man.
I don't think we sold anything that night, but we were like, you know what, let's just set up, see if anybody maybe, you know, is interested and wants to buy a demo. You know, I think our demos were like $3 or something. So yeah, but it was something to do, because otherwise what were we gonna do, sit in the hotel room? Or not even sit in the van.
I was gonna say, like, if you had a hotel room, you're lucky. You're lucky.
Exactly.
So when you're booking tours and stuff, like you just said, like you know, you reached out to Dave from Prayer and he'd had like a show on a certain day. How often did that happen? And like, what's the longest that you would go to play just like a show? Or was like, and like booking a tour when you have situations like that arise where like you're looking for a certain date, but he's got a different date available. Like, how would the routing work for you guys back in the early days?
We just made it. I think there were a couple times we doubled back on a few occasions just to make something work. I mean, there were times we did silly stuff. Like, I think we were in Quebec City and our next show was in New Jersey. Like, and that was an all night, overnight, you know, just to get there. So we did dumb things like that. But at the time, you just didn't want to have the day off. So it was like, you know, day off was no money. We weren't, you know, doing anything. There were definitely times that we had a couple days off here and there, mostly in the early stuff. But for the most part, we just try to fill it in wherever we could. And, you know, you'd just hear about things that were going on. You know, you talk to another band that either was like from that town, and, you know, you try to just make a few phone calls while you were out. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't.
Yeah, luckily for everybody, gas was much cheaper back in the day, and you could double back on some stuff. But you weren't getting that much money anyway, so it's all probably relative. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, we were, yeah. I mean, I can't ever remember a time that back then that we were like, you know, not hoping we'd get enough gas money to make it to the next show.
Yeah. No, it was tough times back then, especially for, like, you know, smaller bands than you. I just threw myself off because I was going to ask you something about touring again, whatever, it's gone. So anyway, 1021 finally coming out on vinyl. What was the decision behind that, finally doing it after all these years? Now it's like 20 plus years.
I'll kind of start this off and then I'll let Andrew take over.
Okay,
so we had that record, actually was originally released by Ferret, and then Ferret got, you know, somehow wrapped up in that whole Warner Brothers acquisition. We didn't have a contract with Ferret, so our record got kind of wrapped up in that whole situation. So we tried to reach out to Warner on several occasions to get, you know, any type of, you know, communication from them. And often what would end up happening was either they wouldn't write us back, or they would write us back until they found out we didn't have a contract. So I'd always wanted to put out the record on vinyl. I was like, hey, let's do this. And for a while, I was like, let's just do this. We were trying to do it the right way. Like, I was like, you know, maybe I could work out something with Warner, but they owe us for the digital royalties for all these years. So let's try to, you know, make this work out. But they wouldn't answer us. So even with the contacts we received from Carl over at Good Fight, who owned Ferret, it just never worked. So there, for a while, I debated on the idea of just simply getting the CD and just taking that to the pressing plant and just putting something out because I always wanted the record on vinyl. It was originally supposed to be released on vinyl. And we actually had artwork done by Jake Bannon at the time back in 2000 when it came out. Jake had done the artwork. We were waiting for a label that was going to be releasing it, and it ultimately fell through. So then I think the next idea we tried was, could we get the actual masters back from the mastering company, which was West West Side? But it turned out technology by that point had changed, and they no longer supported that type of file that these were on. So it was actually, I remember the Alan from West West Side telling us that Suf John Stevens was actually looking for his stuff, and he didn't have enough time to get it for him. And I was like, well, then we're way down on this totem pole here, like, that we're looking for this. So right around COVID, when COVID happened, Andrew kind of got the idea to take the analog tapes that we had and get them, transferred to digital. So I'll let you kind of take over from there in terms of what we did.
So first I had to, we reached out to John, who was in the original lineup, and the tapes were in his garage or something, and who knows where.
Yeah.
And as you know, tapes degrade over time. So it's not like when you recorded it 20 years ago. So,
yeah.
So I had John send me all the tapes, and there was reels in there. There was ADAT tapes. There was DAT tapes. So it was I don't know how many, there's probably eight different
mixed
physical
formats.
Media.
Wow, yeah.
Physical media that we had to look at. And so then I was I need to find a company that can actually take all this stuff and, send it back to me, because not every company can do reels and they just do ADATs or whatever. I forget what the name of the company was, but I had them digitize everything and send it to me, and it was pretty high cost to do that. Get everything digitized. But in doing that, we got and when it came back, it was literally wave files, but it was just 0000, 0001 wave, 0002 wave. So I had to weed through,
figured it all out.
Is this is this a bass track? Is it a vocal? We had to find everything. And then, and it's if you think about how reels are, it's just one big take of every song. Mm-hmm. So it's it might be the vocals for five songs. Yeah. So, and then you have to chop them and put them all back together. So we spent a while just kind of putting it all back together.
Do you have an idea how long that took? How long that process took? Just getting everything in order per song?
Months. Yeah, it's probably months. Wow. To do that.
And I think our original intent at that time, because I was thinking about this today, our original intent was, could we do this ourselves? Could we mix this, just remix it, and then get it mastered and just do it ourselves? And I think with the sheer volume that we ended up finding, it turned out there was just no way we were going to, once it was pieced back together, there was just no way. We were in above our heads at that point.
And that's where you call Will in.
Did we at that point?
Before we get into that, I want to know, because you were saying you didn't have, the contract, and there were some issues with Warner Brothers, and then I know you guys re-recorded some stuff on at least guitar work on the album. So I was wondering if you were just trying to do a Taylor Swift thing where you re-record your whole album and you can put it out yourself. Okay.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I know. So we are doing Sky King Bowling's version, but. When we got everything back together, the guitars, there was just a lot of guitar tracks and they were kind of weak. The bass tracks had all been tracked by me at that point, not Matt, who was the original bassist. And Matt was I want to, if we're going to do any recording stuff, I want to be in on that. Mm-hmm. So then Matt, we had Matt do a whole bunch of bass tracks And my brother went up to Applehead, which is Chris Bittner and Mike Birnbaum.
Okay.
Where all sleeping stuff is recorded. So he went up there and did all the guitars there. And so then it started to come back together again because it brought more life to it. And some of the tapes had degraded to a point where I felt like the quality, even of what we had in the original, it just, it was like not there, like on the guitars for sure. Vocals were great, but we're still really good on the reels. But the guitars and even the drums were needed work. So
how much of the re-release remastered is all new recordings?
Like so 50-50? Most of the guitars and bass are new, but my brother kind of, so when my brother was there doing that cam, he basically took a lot of the guitars there too that were the old guitars and still mixed it with the new guitars because they still had, he didn't want it to lose the vibe of the record.
I got you. Yeah.
But we wanted the guitars to be heavier than what was on the original.
Yeah. And I think that some of what we wrote in the liner notes for this record was how, you know, some of this backstory of how this kind of came together. But at the time we were like 20 years old and recording, like, I mean, I'm sure you probably remember this, but like getting a good recording was everything for the bands that I personally think it kind of, if you got a good recording, people took you seriously. Like think about, you know, we were just talking about this at the show, Poison the Well's record for Opposite of December was like the best recorded record that, you know, I mean, like when that came out, it was like, oh my goodness, like this just sounds so good. That, you know, Dead Guy and Fixation on a Coworker, Earth Crisis records, like those records were all huge sounding. And we were taking those records, not Poison the Wells, but we were taking Earth Crisis. We were taking, you know, Dead Guy's record to the studios and being like, this is what we want to sound like. And studios had no idea. Like we were called a thrash band over and over and over again by the studios we were going to. They were like, oh, yeah, we're really into this thrash metal stuff. And we're like, that's not.
Yeah, it's not really scoring into.
And so what ended up happening was we just, when we wanted to sound heavier, we thought like you need more guitars. So we just layered on like 20 guitar tracks, not realizing that like you just made everything that much muddier and less clear. So like less was more. We didn't know that. We thought more was more. So in the end, I think what we realized now that we've learned over, you know, these years is that, you know, we don't need to do that. So the idea was really just, you know, how can we preserve a lot of what we had and kind of like not take away from the vibe of the original record and kind of pay homage to it, but at the same time, like give it some life that we think it really needs and ultimately, you know, we felt like it deserved.
I feel like it modernizes it too.
Yeah.
Like it brings it to now.
Yeah. So I you know, when you were saying like you, like those certain records, like you mentioned Opposite and Dead Guy and stuff like that. And, though at the time they did sound so good, but like now when I hear, when I go back and listen to like Opposite, I'm like, oh my God, this does not sound that great. But at the time, for the time being, it was awesome and it was so good. And like, you know, I don't even think songs were 320 KPS or whatever when you were like ripping them and downloading them off the internet. I think it was like 128 was like you got a good quality MP3 there. But I talk about sound quality a lot with certain bands because, you know, depending on the genre that you're a part of, like you said, thrash, and certain metal bands like that more, you know, more high-pitched sounding, you know, a lot of contrast in there. It's like, it's not really a lot of low end, so to speak, and it's very tinny. It sounds like you, you know,
sorry,
like you recorded it in a like a metal trash can or something like that. But you know,
the metal's all metal.
A lot of bands are reverting back to that sound too, you know, especially like hardcore and whatnot. You're seeing a lot of bands like really go for that sound, and I just don't know if I don't like hate it, but I think I enjoy something that's really, you know, taken in full effect. Like people care enough about it to make it really sound great. But again, part of the genre, I guess, is sometimes not sounding great on CD and sounding better in person, you know. And I get I get, I'm guilty of like not really listening to certain bands on CD because I don't like the way the audio sounds. But if I see them live, I'm like, holy shit, I get blown away, you know?
Yeah, no, yeah. For sure. I mean, I think that back then, especially the ability to get a good recording was, you know, I mean, for the bands that did, it was somewhat rare. And then there was a ton of bands that were just, you know, you just got crappy recordings. And now to me, everything's so much more accessible. And, you know, I mean, you could get a great recording in a basement. And so, you know, the fact that maybe there are bands out there that are aiming for a specific sound, so be it. But like at the end of the day, like, you know, I think we, you know, for the most part, I think a lot of bands know what they want, you know, going in, and if that's what they're going for, you know, so be it.
How'd you guys link up with Will? Was that something that you sought him out, or did he kind of catch wind of you guys doing stuff? And since you guys were not too far away from him, he's in New Jersey. He's very fond of, I'm sure, like your band and are familiar with it. So how did that, like, how did you guys link up together?
Filled out his web form. Nice. I reached out to him over his contact us form on his website and was like, hey, you know, I don't know, you know, if you know who we are or if you're in like our band, but I think I reached out to him originally to do the remix before we ended up deciding that we were going to do the re-recording. And then I believe Cameron ended up connecting with him through Rob from Incendiary, if I'm not mistaken, because they had recorded their record with him.
Yep.
And they were like, you should have him master it. So ultimately we ended up linking back with him to do the mastering. And he had written me back and was like, yeah, you know, I'm into the band and I'd love to be a part of it. He had done a bunch of the other, some of the other reissues that Ferret Good Fight had done, right, for like Martyr and a couple of the other bands, so Disembodied, etc. So we were, you know, happy to have him on board as well.
That's very cool. I remember the question I was going to ask you about the touring situation, so I will ask that and then tie it in with some new information that came out this week that we can talk about. At what point and why did you decide to go full-time and tour full-time? And, you know, as a young person, maybe I don't know exactly what your ages were when you decided, but like probably when you got out, when everyone was out of high school and you had more ample time, what made you decide to just go full-time? Because at the time, you know, late 90s, not a lot, and currently there's not a lot of money being thrown around really, but there was definitely not a lot of money, and, you know, exposure online was not at its peak. You know, I'm sure some internet stuff was going on when you were touring and whatnot, but it was nothing like mid-2000s MySpace. You know, people were connecting over the early days of social media. So what made you guys want to and decide to do that?
I think for us, it was once we had connected with Ferret, you know, we had kind of told and we had talked to him, you know, like what our plans were, what do we want to do, you know, that type of thing. We had pretty much committed at that point in our lives. Like many of us had nothing else going on, right? Like I worked for my parents. My parents owned, you know, a business. John's dad owned a business. Cameron worked for my parents. You know, our bass player at the time wasn't really working. Our drummer didn't work. So ideally we didn't have anything else going on. So it was like, you know, if we had that ability to just be on the road and support ourselves enough to just, you know, keep going and pay the bills, we had nothing really at home for us at the time. So we just decided that we would just go all in and see kind of what happened. I think probably about halfway after we were like through that tour cycle, we saw a lot of the bands that we were going out with. You know, bands like Thursday, bands like Unearth, bands like, you know, Poison Well is another example, Hope's Fall, etc. A lot of those bands started to kind of, you know, take it to the next level. And at the time, I think there was a lot more being, you know, like Hot Topic and other, you know, started to pay attention to a lot of the bands of our genre or style, right? Like, and those labels like Trustkill, like Ferret, like Victory, etc. So it just kind of made us, kind of propelled us, I think, a little bit toward the end to just keep the ball rolling until we realized, like, yeah, we couldn't keep it going any longer. Yeah. But
you guys took a break for a little while, but you took a break at a time, like I was just saying, where like MySpace and like those early days of like social media were just catching on. Do you ever think, and looking back now, obviously it's 2020 hindsight, but like where you're sitting at now, do you ever think like, man, if we could have just held out for six more months, you know, maybe would have had like a, not a second wave, but like the first wave would have continued going for a little bit longer?
You know, I don't think so. Like, I feel as though like we had kind of run our course, and at the same time, like, we hadn't put out another record. I mean, we had only done, you know, 1021, and I think it was released early 2001. Now we're talking 2003. It was the time for us to like put out another record. We were starting to look for another label at the time. You know, we were in talks with a couple of labels, but at the same time, like, it just, it's sort of, you know, I've always described it as kind of like, it started to feel like a job. It started to feel like where we were getting to the point, and this is especially true, where we put out those last two songs. I don't know if you ever heard them before, but we put out these last two songs.
Is that the Sky Came Falling EP?
Yes.
Okay.
And they were intended to be a demo. They were intended to shop to labels. And most of that was done because we had people in our ears, so to speak, you know, saying like, hey, you guys should be more melodic. You guys should sing more. You guys should do this. You guys should do that. And when you're out on the road, you know, 10 months out of the year getting $5 a day, and people are saying like, hey, you should sing more, or you should be more melodic, or you should do this, or you should do that, you start to think like, is that the is that the magic bullet? Is that the key to unlock that we can maybe gain some fan base or maybe take it to the next level? And that's what those demos actually were to me, right? It felt a little bit forced at times, and I don't really think it was something that we were intending to release. But at the same time, it's like, if we had done a whole record like that, I don't really think that would have done anything for us. So to me, I feel like we ended at the right time. I think we were, I think we had kind of gotten to the end of where the life of the band was, and where, you know, being in a van for 10 months out of the year for 3 or 4 years with the same guys, like we were done, like we were tired.
Tapped out, yeah. I do remember, and again, because I got into like all this kind of stuff in my last couple years of high school, coming over from the nu metal world. I remember, you know, getting a hold of like Victory Records, Trustkill Records, and Ferret Records, and I just remember you guys being like always on like the comps or always, you know, touring with those bands. But you guys ended so abruptly, like even before I was in a band, I never really got to see you guys. And it was just cool because, like, again, you know, you did the Poison Well show, and that came full circle and whatnot. How did that even come about for you guys? I mean, granted, you come from the same almost era as Poison the Well and whatnot, but, you know, they're from South Florida, you guys are from Long Island. How did they decide to go with you guys for the New York shows? And how did that come about?
Yeah, I don't know how it all came together, like, meaning, like, you know, as far as, like, what prompted who to ask us to play. What I do know is, you know, I knew Poison the Well from when they were an Acre Lost. Like, I don't know if maybe you're too young to remember it, but Victory Records used to have a chat room.
Yeah, no, I remember chat rooms.
So, yeah, it was called Vic Chat, and I met their singer, their first singer, on Vic Chat. And we became friends, and we traded tapes, because that's what I was doing at the time. Like, we had our demo, and I would meet these other bands, and I'd be like, oh, I'll send you my demo. Send me your demo. And I'd had them come up and play a couple of shows, like, in basements here on Long Island, before Opposite, you know, had come out, and even, you know, before they had signed to Trustkill. And I was talking with their manager at this last show, and I guess there was some kind of discussion over, you know, who would be a good band to support Poison the Well at these shows that is local, and our name was thrown out there, and ultimately we got asked to play. It just felt like the timing, given what we had going on with the vinyl, like, you know, and that was some, we had intended for that record to be released on 1021 of last year. Was our goal, but it didn't really, the cycles didn't, it really didn't come together. So what we decided was, you know what, like, that's the right time for us to make that announcement. But at the same time, it felt like, you know, things were kind of converging so that, you know, we got asked to play the show, and we had this other thing coming out. So it just felt like the right time with those two things kind of coming together.
Interesting.
Yeah, and also we had Cam was like he was living in Mexico and also in California. So he wasn't around for a long time, mm-hmm. Play shows, and he had just moved back to Long Island. So we had like everyone here.
Oh, now. Cool.
So it made it a little bit easier to play this show, minus Matt. Matt's in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And the lineups were really interesting for each, you know, city that they played in. The New York one was more, I want to say legacy band oriented, but I don't necessarily, the opener for the show, I don't know too much about those guys, yeah. But it seemed, it seemed like, you know, Indecision and you guys were coming from way back in the day, which I thought was cool, because the other, like, and it was cool that in the California shows, they had some newer bands open up, like Sky Came Falling, See You Space Cowboy. But, you know, that was pretty neat. Speaking of, like, coming back and having things going on in your timeline now, you guys just also announced this week that you guys are playing Furnace Fest. And, you know, they have the ability to kind of get these old bands back together, reunion style. Not saying that you guys, you know, weren't doing stuff for the last couple of years, but I don't think you were doing anything at this frequency, it seemed like. So I could be completely wrong about that, and you can correct me. But how did the Furnace Fest thing come about, and how do you guys feel about playing that kind of festival at this particular time?
Yeah, so they had actually reached out to us, I think, for the first one. Mm-hmm. They had reached out and sent an email.
The first of the newer ones.
The first of the newer ones.
Yeah, 21.
They reached out to us. Yeah,
2020 yeah. or 21. I know one was canceled.
It was 2000. Back. Yeah, I think it was 2001. And at the time, it just wasn't the right time for us. Like, I had a medically complex son who was like, COVID was a very real thing for our family. And, you know, I told him, like, hey, there's just no way that we could do this. Like, we can't make this work. Like, you know, my family was still quarantined at that time. So a couple years later, we had reached out to them and said, hey, you know, if you guys do need us, you know, we had some momentum going with, you know, the things we were doing behind the scenes. That didn't come together. And then this time around, it just, you know, once we had played the Poison the Well shows, like shortly thereafter, they had reached out to us, and it just all kind of came together. So,
oh, so that's like a recent thing, like that whole thing happening literally was in a handful of weeks.
Yeah, that came together within a couple of weeks right after the Poison Well show. I mean, it was probably about 5 or 10 days later, I think.
After announcing the shows or after playing the shows?
Playing the shows.
Oh, wow. So that like just happened this past week or something like that. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, like right after we played the shows, we got the offer and then we accepted and then they announced it. We thought maybe they were going to wait and they had told us, sent us a message saying, hey, we're going to announce, you know, this Thursday. And we were like, all right, let's go. Let's do it. So... Yeah, wow. I'm excited. I mean, it's I haven't been to any of them since the one that we had played, which I looked up. I think it was 2002 was when we played. So I'm psyched to be back down there. I'm psyched to see the bands that are playing. You know, I see all the photos of everyone. Saying,
heads up, it's a lot. It's a way bigger than back in those days.
Honestly, I don't. You know, toward the end of the band, because that was right around when we were ending. The only vivid memory I have of that. Was we, and I am convinced, you talked about long drives and dumb things we did. I'm convinced that because I can't find any remnant of a flyer or anything, I'm convinced we were driving from New York down to Birmingham.
That sounds about right.
And we broke down in Tennessee somewhere, and we actually needed our engine rebuilt.
Wow.
So we had like blown the head gasket. So we rented a yellow Xterra. I remember this specifically. and a U-Haul, like a, you know, like a Ryder, like, you know, like a box truck.
Yeah.
We put all our equipment in the box truck. John and our merch guy Race drove to Alabama. We drove in the Xterra, the four of us, to go play down there. And we drove all the way back home after that show. And then we paid the guy who rebuilt the engine to drive our van all the way back up for us. And I remember because his name was Country, was what his name was.
As it should be, as it should be from Tennessee.
Exactly, yeah. Which was, and I know, I recall this memory pretty vividly, was that our guitar player John's dad paid him, and when he called the shop to find out if he had left, the guy was like, why did you give that guy money? Like, he's an alcoholic, and he's probably not going to bring your van back. And believe it or not, he did. But it's just one of those stories that, like, is pretty wild. But like I said, I'm fairly certain we drove from New York to Birmingham.
Yeah, and I'm fairly certain you probably were in the red after that whole insane trip because...
Probably.
Yeah.
It's probably another reason as to why... as to why we broke up. I mean, there's no, I mean, you know, I remember when the Under Oath tour and, you know, was cut short abruptly because all of us were broke. Like, Under Oath was broke and so were we.
Yeah.
And no one was coming to the shows.
I'm looking at that article right now on Lambda from 2002, August 23rd, 2002. Sky Came Falling Under Oath tour canceled. It doesn't say because you were broke, but. Now we got a little backstory on it.
That's why, I mean, we were in Kansas City, Missouri, and playing in front of like 15 or 20 people, and it just wasn't sustainable. Like, we were just, no one was making any money. And for whatever reason, that tour just never got off the ground. And Under Oath was like, hey, we're done. And we were like, we're going home too. And we all just ended there. And that was it. That was pretty much the end of the band right there.
Yeah, you're blowing people's mind. They're thinking Under Oath, you know, canceling a tour is unheard of, but this is also like more death metal-y Under Oath, not the whole
This is chasing of safety. Time
Under Oath. It's not chasing safety and after. This is prior to all that. Yeah, Dallas is still singing
post-death metal right in that, like, I actually just listened to the record the other day for the first time in since then. And remembered, I love that record. I thought it was great. And but it was such a transitional point for them on that Changing of Times record. And it just, I don't know what it was. It just was just a tour where either both of us had toured continually maybe for a long period of time and people were just sick of seeing us, or just for whatever reason, it just never for I think 5 or 6 shows we made, I think none of us made money.
Yeah. That would happen back in the day. You're lucky to get any kind of thing or sleep on a fucking floor of someone's house, let alone a hotel. But so I want to talk of like possible future stuff. Clearly, you're going to be playing in October in Birmingham. Is there going to be more? And again, you don't have to say anything, but this comes out next week. So if you have stuff planned that's not going to be public knowledge before next week, then just kind of don't make me have to edit this thing. You know what I'm saying? So don't say anything you don't want to say. But will you have more shows leading to and from that the festival? And also, you know, with all the hoopla of the 1021 coming out and all this and the shows that you've played, are you thinking about new songs, EP, album, or anything like that in the near future?
I'll say, as far as playing a record release when the vinyl is in hand, yeah, we most likely will coordinate something like that, local to the New York area. For Birmingham, I don't think we're going to do anything. Like, we'll probably fly down there and, you know, look at it, you know, as a kind of like a one-off show.
Okay.
If other opportunities come up, you know, I think we'd assess them and look to see if it makes sense for us. You know, I'd love to do something on the West Coast. I think that would be, you know, to get back out there, would be great. But I don't see us like getting in a van and, you know, doing any type of touring or anything like that. The other thing, as far as like new music, I'm sort of, we've got a couple of leftover tracks from 1021 that were recorded musically where there's no vocals. You know, we've talked about, and we actually, that was one of the ideas we originally had when we started to do 1021. We were like, maybe we'll do those songs and add them as bonus and keep it, you know, as the record that it is. But we ended up where, you know, we did the remix remaster. So we still have those two songs that were left over. You know, we've kicked around, you know, that idea. Years ago, we kicked around the idea of doing something new. I'm kind of on the fence about it. You know, I've seen bands kind of come back. Some of them do it really well. Others, yeah. You know, you kind of wish they
hurt
never
the legacy a little bit. A little, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So like, granted, you know, we're not a big band. You know, I don't necessarily feel like, you know, we've got much of a legacy to undo. But at the same time, like, I don't really want to put something that I don't think sounds like us, because I mean, at the end of the day, like, this band was very much like a place in time, you know, like it's sort of a moment. And especially around these two records, as far as, you know, the internally how we look at it. So, you know, if we do anything, I'd want to make sure that it's, you know, the right thing, the right sound. I don't really feel like as a band, like I want to, you know, push boundaries. Like, gotcha. I want to keep it to what it is.
Yeah. And I have to agree with you. It definitely is like a timepiece of that era. I'm walking around Target today listening to it, and I'm like, dude, this is like very indicative of like all the early 2000s. Like, there's so much, whether you influenced a band or you pulled influences from bands around that same time too. Like, you know, they're just like things you could hear in other songs and other bands from that era. And it's kind of wild how that all kind of transpired between areas of the country, because there's not like, you know, there wasn't MySpace at that point. There wasn't like well, I guess maybe Napster was around, but I don't know how much hardcore and metalcore and metal were being, you know, transferred on Napster. But it's crazy how those influences spread around the country, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, we were a lot of the bands that we were into around that time, we were seeing at, you know, Hellfest, the early Hellfest, you know, like Morning Again, Culture, like that was our first exposure to bands like that. You know, so we were hearing those bands and that genre, and that was kind of like what we were into, you know. Like, I was super into bands like, you know, Day of Suffering, and, you know, it was kind of funny because as we started to do more touring and we got down into like the North Carolina, you know, the North Carolina, like the Carolinas actually, like we started to play with bands like Hope's Fall, and we're like, it's kind of ironic that, you know, in to some degree, we all sounded similar. We were drawing from the same influences, kind of all the way down the East Coast, you know, all the way to South Florida. So it's just funny the way that kind of all worked out.
Yeah. So I have to ask, what's the goal then for Sky Came Falling? If not to, you know, I don't want to say change the sound, but put out another record that's not, you know, representative of the band, you know, what's the idea for coming back and playing the shows and playing Furnace Fest? Is it just kind of like a cool hobby side thing, which, again, a lot of us at this particular age don't have the ability to, like you said, pound the pavement in the van for months on end, and, you know, they do weekenders or, like, you know, one-off shows every now and then. What's the overall goal for Sky Came Falling at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, for us, it's, you know, I'll be honest when I say I think that, you know, when we were around, we had some great shows, you know, like, but things weren't like they are today, right? Mm-hmm. And we got a lot of kids, you know, or a lot of people writing to us, a lot of people, you know, hey, you guys should play the show. I can't, you know, I'd love to see you guys. You know, some of it really is just, you know, the nostalgia aspect of it, like revisiting something where, you know, we never got to, I wouldn't say, you know, we didn't get our due, because that's not really the way that I feel, but it's more like, you know, if we could play to a new group of people that had never seen us before and are interested and want to see us play, and then, yeah, like that's kind of like what we're looking to do. It's, I don't, you know, we want to take control of the music we had, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. We finally were able to get to 1021 to where, you know, we're happy with it and be able to release that on our own and have the means to do that. You know, we own the EP, we've owned it for years. So ideally we want to do something with that. I don't necessarily know to the same level that we did with 1021, but I'd like to see that get a re-release, at some point. And then, you know, for the most part, just if, like I said, if the show seems right, you know, we'll play. I'd love to, you know, get out there to some, I mean, listen, I've never been to Japan. I'd love to go to Japan.
Yeah, all you had to do was wait. All you had to do was throw that, you know, album out in the water, wait 20 something years, and then maybe you can catch some bigger fish around the world, you know?
Hold it up in a bottle. Yeah. Right. But yeah, I mean, I'd love to do something like that. You know, We went to Europe once, you know, so there's a couple of places that I'd love to go see if the right opportunity happened. I think we'd all be, you know, into it. But yeah, I don't really put any kind of guardrails on it right now. Like if the right thing comes along in the right place and it's the right time for us, we'll do it.
How active were you guys? How active have you been the last couple of years? Has it just been like one show every couple of years, or because it's I went through like the database, right, for Lambgoat, because we do have all your early posts and stuff, which I thought was really cool, because we have stuff.
Lambgoat was an early supporter.
Oh, I know.
It was actually nice. There was always like news and like tidbits or something like that. Yeah.
And so I think that's I'm not the original owner. I took over for Alex, you know, a couple years ago. But I think that one of the things I hold very dear is that we are one of those websites that was online at that particular time. So like, you know, what's the earliest Sky Came Falling post we have? November 9th, 2000. That's the earliest Sky Came Falling, you know, post on Lambgoat. So it's really cool that, you know, you can go back through time technically and get all the nostalgia dopamine rush if you wanted to. But, you know, to piggyback off of like what I think maybe the goal situation might be, and you wanted to play all this, that, the other stuff, it would be great, I think, if you were able to not write a full length, but maybe just a couple songs or whatnot that were very similar to the time that you guys were around, like the earlier stuff. I know it'd probably be a little difficult because there's no way that the last 20 something years hasn't influenced you in some way in your brain. But, you know, like I said, I was listening to that, listening to 1021 again, walking through Target, and I was like, God damn, it does take you back to like when I was a kid going to shows for the first couple of years, you know what I mean? And I think it'd be really cool if you were able to work it out to where you could make something similar sounding like that nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, we do have those two songs that we like uncovered, like that were on, that were supposed to be in.
Oh no.
Do something like that, and yeah, if we did, I think it would be a short release. I don't think we would do like anything.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about those two songs possibly, and like maybe a new instrumental, something along those lines, which I think would be cool. You know, those songs are a little bit different to a degree, but obviously they fit in with the material that we were writing and recording at that time. But yeah, I mean, years ago we tried to write some new stuff, and
yeah, that was like
it kind of all
2018, right?
Yeah, it was like it kind of all came out like, I hate to say, like, too good. Like, Cameron's a great guitar player and he's really progressed as a musician.
Yeah.
But it didn't sound like us. Like, it was very, you know, so different from what I remember. Part of what I've said to the guys is that like the reason that the songs were the way they were was because we were young. Like, we didn't know what we were doing. So like, you know, maybe you're combining two parts that shouldn't be there. You know, that shouldn't be together. Or maybe you're going to stop after every single part you wrote and transition into the next part.
Yeah.
You know, like, those were things that you did because you were like, well, we don't know, you know, how to write a bridge. So like, we'll just stop and then, you know, we'll start the next part. And, you know, then the drums come in. So, you know, when everything was kind of flowing and it was this like one, you know, couple of songs that we had musically, it just didn't really feel like us, and we kind of scrapped all those sessions that we had.
I feel that. And I do feel the whole like writing process, like you were just mentioning, with everyone being younger, just not knowing anything about songwriting or whatnot. And you can definitely tell, like, especially when shortly after you guys kind of, you know, went on hiatus or whatever, you know, MTV started catching wind of all this kind of music, and then you'd have like bands entering bigger studios and working with bigger producers, and then all of a sudden songwriting became better, and you know, it did push the genres a little bit, but then you lose a little something, you know, I don't know if it's like the, you know, the youth of the whole thing, but you lose something to where it's like you said, some stuff is too good.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you know, so many of those times I remember just, you know, Cameron would come up with a part and then, you know, Matt would have another part and we'd just be like, well, how do we make these two parts, you know, kind of meet?
Just and shove
you didn't
them
really have, yeah, you just shove them together. You didn't have a proper transition. You just, that's the way it went. So, you know, I listen back to the demo sometimes and I'm just like, it's amazing to me that, you know, those songs, but it was just, again, it was, you know, we were young, naive, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. We just kind of had ideas and came together and just wanted to sound like other bands.
I get you. Andrew, I definitely want to bring up the sleeping since we've talked up for like 50 plus minutes about Sky King Falling.
Posters behind us.
So. Yeah. And I have to say, I don't know if you're technically a part of Questions and Answers, but Questions and Answers. I think you came in a little.
My brother just called me up. They were doing a tour with Sunny Day, and they were like, "Hey, we just need someone to do some keyboard parts for you for this tour." And I was like, "Sunny Day, yes, like I'll do that tour." So my brother has a keyboard, and we just kind of worked on a few parts on that, and they're already in the songs. Like, I didn't write those or anything. So, I just went on the road with them for, I think it was like 5 dates with Sunny Day. Mm. So, and I'm not like in the band. It's just kind of like, I just tour with them every once in a while to, help them out.
Yeah.
So,
that's cool.
But actually, one thing I'll say is like, when my brother recorded a new record with The Sleeping, it actually, it's kind of the reason why the guitars in The Sky King Falling actually got recorded up in Applehead, because he on the side was like, "Hey, I have this Sky King Falling record. I need like some help with it," and kind of brought in the Applehead guys to then mix and record stuff. Like that kind of all, like the timing of it all, like synced up, and that's how it happened.
We've kind of rode some of the, they've sort of forged some of the path that we've been able to utilize. Like, they self-released their own album recently.
Talking about The Sleeping?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Sleeping.
They did a Kickstarter. A lot of those ideas were ideas that Andrew and I, when we were getting this whole thing together, were kicking around. Should we do a Kickstarter? Should we do this? Should we do that? How should we go about doing this? The Sleeping kind of getting ahead of us and doing those things in front of us allowed us to realize, utilize some of them, correct some of the mistakes that they had made when they had realized, like, maybe that wasn't the wisest idea to do this. We've been able to kind of utilize that to, basically make our whole thing.
Yeah, like steer our ship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's worked out well for us in that respect.
I had Doug on the podcast a while ago, probably like during COVID or right after COVID times, but it was interesting to see how close he was with you guys in the beginning. I think I'm correct in thinking he was like the young kid hanging out at your space a lot back in the day.
Yeah, so the way that it kind of worked was when Sky King Falling broke up, the idea was originally to have, so the last lineup of Sky King Falling was myself, John on guitar, Cameron on guitar, Sal on bass, and Joe on drums. Joe, Sal, and Cameron formed The Sleeping. Mm-hmm. I was originally intending to be the vocalist of that band, but backed out. I was like, I'm not really a singer. And I knew what they needed.
Yeah.
And they got Doug. And so at that time, Doug, I think, was living in the studio.
That's what he said,
there's a great story about him. There was a payphone. I don't know if he told that story on the podcast.
I'm trying to, if you start telling me, it'll come back. But he definitely told some stories. But yeah, go ahead.
There was a payphone in the studio that had nobody knew the number to it. Doug, when he was staying at the studio, you couldn't get a hold of him. But the phone rang one day and he ran over to it and picked it up. And they were obviously had the wrong number, but he was like, "What number did you dial?" So he wrote down the number so that now we had if you wanted to reach Doug, you called the studio and he would pick up the payphone that was outside inside the studio. So that's how we would all get in touch with Doug. But yeah, he was living in the studio at that time. And those guys were like, they were workhorses. Like they practiced day and night. And then I ultimately ended up releasing their first album.
Was that, is that Questions and Answers or no? That's.
No, it was Believe What We Tell You.
Yeah. Okay.
The first one. Yeah.
Yeah. Now did that, I don't necessarily know. I mean, you were a part of the original talks for the band, so I feel comfortable asking, but the idea for that project, did that come out of the idea, or did that come from the band Sky King Falling disbanding, but also like all those people in your ear about like, you should sing more, you should do this, this is like more profitable, that yada yada, because there's a drastic difference between The Sleeping and Sky Came Falling. So
yeah, I think, you know, we were all listening to lighter music at the time. Like one of our favorite records, I remember this, was we were all really into the Code 7 record was The Rescue. Mm-hmm. That red record, like, we were super into that record. So we were starting to get into, like, much more melodic stuff.
Okay.
Like, we were starting to listen to a lot of bands in those genres. Like, I think one of the bands that we were all really into, and I don't know if you were into music by then, but, like, when The Used first broke, like, that first record was fantastic when we were young. Like, we were on, like, we actually saw that band on Warped Tour, because we were somehow, it landed on a few Warped Tour dates at the time. And we actually watched The Used go from, like, a side stage band to have to move up to an actual, you know, one of the bigger stages, because their crowds were so big.
Yeah.
And so we were getting really into the music like that. And I think that toward the end of the band, you know, it was sort of a natural progression for them to start playing a genre that was more melodic. And I think Sky Came Falling intended to try to capture some of that. We just, you know, vocally, I didn't know how. Mm. But in the same sense, like, I think we were starting to head in that direction. There was some aspect of that being a natural progression, and some aspects of that being like, you know, hey, why don't we give this a shot? Because I could have screamed over that whole record, you know, on the last EP, but, you know, I was trying something. I was like, hey, you know, maybe we'll do this. This is what the bands that I like are doing, you know, maybe I could try that. But for The Sleeping, I think it was a little bit more of a natural progression for them to kind of see that. And Sal was always into very melodic music as well. So the other thing that's also kind of that I, you know, failed to mention is the fact that, like, the Sky Came Falling that wrote that EP and the Sky Came Falling that wrote the full length are completely different bands.
Yeah.
So
lineup wise.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, hour goes by quick, does it not?
It does.
Well, let's wrap it up with this. Is there anything else that you guys want to kind of, like, give a dish out or say before we kind of, you know, depart this evening?
You got anything? I'm good.
No, I mean, thank you for doing this. This was great. I appreciate you reaching out. Other than that, yeah, I think we're right now just, we'll be dropping some new tracks. Not new tracks, but new old tracks.
New to us.
Yeah, new to everyone else. We'll be kind of doing that.
Oh, yeah, we did. We should mention that we released Laura Palmer as a single.
Yes, yeah. I did see that. I did see that today.
Yeah.
I have to make a post about that.
That's the new version of,
like, yeah,
the Sky Falling version.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to seeing you for a third time this year, come October. I literally said that the other day. I was like, go figure. I never saw that band ever in my 40 years of life. And now, in one, like, six-month period, I'm going to see them three times.
Well, funny, we were just about to announce a Jacksonville show, so funny enough.
Are you really?
No, I'm just
okay. I was like, what? That's a whole fucking tour now. No. I'll see you guys in Birmingham, though, nonetheless, and it'll be a great time. I don't know how long you're staying, but if you're staying for more than the weekend, or, you know, if you're staying for the weekend, we, on our first night there, I think Thursday night or whatever, I usually try to get a little get-together with some bands after the pre-show. So if you're there for the pre-show but on the Thursday, or I don't know what the schedule is like now, but usually the day before the festival, I kind of try to arrange a little hangout for bands at this little Marty's PM. You're more than welcome to, you know, join us. I'll remind you via email if you're able to make it or not. But if not, no hard feelings. We'll just get you a round or two. You know what I mean?
Yeah, all good. No, appreciate it.
All right, guys. Awesome. I appreciate your time. I look forward to seeing you, like I said earlier. And, yeah, thanks for doing the show.
Yeah, thanks all for
right.
having us.
All right.
Take it easy, y'all.
See you in October.
Yep.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.